Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. I am so honored to welcome Michael Mead to this episode. Michael is a renowned storyteller, author, and scholar of mythology, anthropology, and psychology. His work has had a profound influence on me, whether through his books, his Living Myth podcast, or the wisdom he shares so generously across many platforms. Michael has a rare gift for weaving hypnotic storytelling with street-savvy wisdom, interpreting ancient myths through a deeply human, cross-cultural lens. He distills ancestral knowledge and connects it to the modern world in a way that feels both timeless and urgently relevant. As the founder of the Mosaic Multicultural Foundation, he has worked for decades to build bridges across differences, creating spaces for transformation and understanding through story, ritual, and community. In all of his work, Michael reminds us that endings are never final, but they are thresholds, what mythology calls liminal space, where the old world unravels and something new is allowed to emerge. In this conversation, we talk about regeneration as a return to wholeness and how we might grow the soul in times of collapse. We explore ancient wisdom, modern rites of passage, the healing power of story and nature, and the role imagination plays in shaping a more meaningful, soulful life. Join me for this rich and layered conversation about soul, transformation, and remembering what connects us all. Hello, Michael. It is so good to see you live right now.
It's great to see you.
See, what you don't know is how much of you I actually get to spend time with. You have so many beautiful offerings, some of them free, some of them in book form, many in video form, and I so appreciate it. Just know I'm out there. So when I think about what regeneration means to me at this point in my life, I think about a return to wholeness, possibly renewal through transformation, and I mean it personally at every level. And so you came up as a brilliant voice who is always talking about these kinds of rhythms. And I'm wondering if you might start us out just by saying what regeneration or transformation, what these things mean to you in this context?
Well, first thing that comes to mind is we are in a time of collective transformation. Transformation essentially means to move, to transit from one form to another. And that's what's happening collectively. I mean, the world we used to think we had or knew is gone. It's not coming back. And people trying to go back there are going to be unsuccessful. But we're not yet in contact or in clear vision with the world that's coming. So I'm using the old mythological idea that the world doesn't come to an end, that each end is actually a regenerative beginning. And the word end itself doesn't mean final act. It means loose thread or remnant. And so when everything seems to unravel from the loose threads, life creates itself again. So one dynamic is transformation, The other thing that, as someone who studies mythology, totally paying attention to is recreation. So every culture has creation myths, and all of them have more than one, as if you can't capture it in a single story or even a collection of stories, because it's so multiple and intricate and interconnected in its essence. But in the studying of creation myths, I realized they're all recreation myths. They're all really about recreating. And then if you go to traditional cultures and indigenous people in many parts of the world, they would use the creation myths as a recreation of time, as a way to renew their energies individually and collectively. And most traditional cultures would have rituals that were intended to recreate and elevate the energy of the culture. And so those are the first things I think of. And maybe to add one other thing, we're between the world that's disappearing and was unsustainable, and the world that hasn't fully appeared that hopefully becomes much more sustainable and more than sustainable. And that space in between is often referred to as the liminal space, liminal being the old word for the bottom of a doorway. So we're in a threshold condition. We're on the threshold in which we leave the old world behind and we begin or get ready to step into the new world, but we're neither in one place nor the other. And that's a partial way to explain all of the chaos and confusion and all of the anxiety that everybody's feeling, because we are betwixt and between.
Well, it reminds me of chaos theory and how we watch for emergence, I think, is one of the terms that are used. So it makes me wonder, you mentioned loose threads, I think, and I'm wondering, are we looking for how we're forming new ritual? Are you seeing this happening, or are we still in the blowing up, the Big Bang? Are we still in the Big Bang of the old?
Well, if we go to very old ideas like apocalypse, which is an old Greek word and an old Greek concept, but it doesn't mean the zombie return, and it doesn't mean the fiery end of the world. On one level, it means the lifting of the veil, and we see behind the superficial element of life. Well, in politics, what was done in the back room is done right in front of everybody now. So the veil lifts, and we see more of the rudiments and the core threads of nature and culture. But the other meaning of apocalypse is collapse, renewal. And it's not collapse and then renewal. It's collapse and renewal happening at the same time, the way it happens in a forest. So one of the advantages our ancestors had, besides being more connected to the regenerative energies of nature, is they knew how to read the book of nature. Because nature is constantly in transformation. A forest is in collapse and renewal moment to moment. And so our ancestors literally would be reading nature to understand how to handle or react to circumstances, or how to understand the nature of transformation, because nature is the evidence of transformation in the world. And so when modern culture separated culture from nature and separated subject from object and exaggerated objectifying things, we lost the threads that naturally people have had throughout time, the threads that connected the human soul to the soul of the world, or the individual soul to the dynamic of nature. So I assume that regeneration, whether it's at the level of agriculture or at the level of organization or at the level of imagination, is going to be a refining of the threads and a reweaving of the threads. And in mythology, it would often be depicted as emergence. And the idea that the new life is emerging from below, which is the process in many forests and many natural situations. So from the modern concepts, people freak out. The whole world's going to end and all that stuff. Mythologically, the world can't end. But also from the point of view of nature, an ending is a beginning. Just like when the big trees fall down and rotten, then the rest of the new trees comes from the collapsing of the big trees. So if we were to be closer to nature, we'd be less anxious.
I would agree with you. And I've discovered that for myself in my own exploration the last 5 or so years, deep into the property here where I've been living. And what I would also say is that decades ago, I got interested in Taoism, and that I consider a philosophy of nature. And it got me to think in situations, what would nature do? And this is poetry that one has to unpack and interpret. But I love that, what you say. But I also am aware, you've said, and you would say it better, that when things are falling apart out there, we need to grow the soul. And my suspicion personally is that the imagination is needed to grow the soul. But I'd love for you to talk a little bit about what you mean by grow the soul.
So there's two basic ideas about the nature of the human soul. One is called tabula rasa, the blank slate theory. And the idea that a person comes in with a blank soul, and then your parents write on your soul, and your family writes on you, and your educators write on you, and you become the sum total of things that have impressed you from the outside. Tabula rasa. The other theory is a gifted, aimed soul, that each soul comes into the world gifted and aimed. It has an inherent purpose. And that's the theory or the understanding or the imagination of all ancient cultures. And when you study stories, there's no stories about the blank slate until you get to scientism. And I don't mean science, I mean scientism. The exaggeration of the functioning of reasoning and the reason for science. Science was connected to both art and nature. It only got separated in the course of the development of the Western world. So once you take on the idea that the soul is gifted and named, well, the other key word there is unique. Each soul born is unique and will be never repeated again. And that's a learning from nature. Each crow is unique. Each tree is unique. So are we, because our second nature is nature. People used to call the inner nature, the second nature, is nature. We're divorced from the roots of our own nature. But stories, and all the old stories, are about how the person comes in gifted and aimed. Then what happens is the family doesn't know the gifts of their own children. That's a setup. That's the human setup. And therefore, it isn't the function or the job of the family to decide the career of their children or even to bless their gifts. I mean, in a certain sense, the job of the parents is to nourish, love, and protect the children. But the children's lives, the children's souls, that's their own issue from before birth. So then what happens is the child eventually has to leave home because you can never give them all of what they need, because part of what they need is to find themselves. They have to get out of one home to find the home of their deep self. So off they go, and they succeed, they fail, they fall, all that happens. But eventually the idea is to reconnect with the essence of one's own soul, which is partly gifted and partly aimed. It has a purpose. And then that begins the growth of the soul. So the soul is this really a mysterious thing. It's not exactly a substance. It's not exactly a spirit. It's a soul. They used to say soul is the connective tissue and the glue of the world. Soul is what holds us together, body and spirit. It's hard to define it. You can't capture it. But if you don't have it, you're really in trouble. So then on a kind of a developmental or even regenerative level, the job is to grow one's soul. And that means to become more aware of one's gifts, to become tuned into one's innate purpose in life, and to learn how to live in connection with the things that are most meaningful to oneself. And that usually means other people, but it almost always means nature in some form. Native American tribes, generally speaking, had something called the second soul. And the first soul was connected to your body and your dreams and so on. The second soul was connected distinctly and specifically to a part of nature. It could be a bird or a deer. It could be a tree or a plant. So everyone had this way of growing their soul by becoming more conscious and aware and more vibrant connection to a part of nature that already was threaded to their soul. So you could grow by connection to nature. Then you also grow by expanding your capacity to give your gifts. In this old story of the soul, the natural gifts, when you give them, they grow greater. So not only do you grow your soul, but you grow more capacity to give your gifts, because the gifts are tied to something eternal, and therefore they can't run out. It's the opposite of the modern theory of not enough to go around. And then the other thing of growing the soul would be in following one's purpose, a person automatically is benefiting the people around them. And so the soul grows by having more dynamic, creative, compassionate, and wise connection to other beings, which could be people, but it's also horses and animals and whatever way a person's soul grows. And so eventually a person becomes indispensable. In other words, they're so connected to so many things that are meaningful and they're threaded into the world in many ways so that they seem not just unique, but indispensable. As tribes in Africa will say, when a person dies, then the star in the heavens that was secretly threaded through their heart falls like a falling star. And the whole cosmos knows that something meaningful is no longer with us. So that would be a grown soul that would be felt not just by the loved ones, but by everyone who encounters them and apparently the stars.
That's beautiful. And you really touched me because I just lost my father, who had a very poetic, unique, and nature-connected soul. I feel that ongoingly, not necessarily in a tragic way. He was 97 and a half, God bless him. But I feel that you just said.
And it is a loss. It can be joyful and it can be beautiful. And when someone lives their life fully, that's a beautiful thing. That's a reason to sing.
And uniquely is what you said. And so what I want to comment here is that what I hear you describing is that the soul's journey, it's a journey. And it's also, it feels like a process out, you go out with it, but it's also a reflection in, and it's a discovery that you may have an inkling or you may not. I look at young people and think, oh, I don't know what I want to do. And there's still the old paradigm where I have to plug into some career, but there's a new thing happening where, or do I, you know, or do I need to now go pave some new territory that no one's ever heard of? Sadly, a lot of times what that's tied to and become a tech billionaire, like I'm going to invent something and, you know, strike it rich. But I do feel a process notion to the term soul.
Yeah. Soul is connective tissue in motion. If you think of the mushrooms at the roots of all the trees and all, soul is like that. It's connecting things that are rooted. People talk about soul food. It's used commonly, and it's usually used as something that moves you. You feel connected to that kind of food and those values, or soul music even, is something that moves you deep in your body. And so soul is the connective energy between spirit and body and between spirit and matter. And when the world got divided in two, which begins back in the Council of Nicaea in 527 or whatever, the Catholic Church decided to not have the soul anymore and to remove it because the soul was causing trouble, because the soul meant you were connected to your ancestors. You were still connected to your ancestors. The soul meant you were connected to nature.
And your own senses, right?
Yes. And they weren't the first ones to try it, to separate spirit and body. Can't really do it. You can't separate body from spirit, because as soon as you remove the body, the spirit has no way to show up. They're essentially connected, and they're both vehicles of the divine, would be the old understanding. That is to say, something that is enduring and eternal is trying to enter the world through the spirit of each person, through the body of each person, and through the soul of each person. And so when they did that separation, soul got lost. And you could say we live in modern cultures are lost. Be modern is to be lost. Most people think that they're just a speck in a dark universe. And whereas all the ancient people thought they were an expression of the cosmos, a unique expression rather than a lost soul. So the bad news is the cultures are lost now. The modern cultural ideas are opposed to nature. And so we're lost, and young people are often more lost because they think they have to have a career that they find outside themselves. The good news is we're on the path to not be lost again, but to refine and regenerate our connections to the ancestors, to the animals, to the plants, to the forests, through our own inner souls, and through the callings that we naturally have in life.
Well, you use storytelling and ancient myths, maybe not all ancient, but many of them are, and those are still useful tools. I mean, it's an unusual vocation, I'm going to say. I was just picturing like the unemployment office. It's like, is there an opening for a storyteller mythologist? But there you are. You've been doing it for decades and decades. So I'm curious about how the ancient stories, the act of storytelling, which in a sense we all do ongoingly, but how is it the same or different from what you're talking about?
Storytelling is human language. And the word relationships, relatare, Latin verb, means to bring it back. And it means to keep bringing your story back to someone who brings their story back to you. I mean, a relationship is a shared story or a sharing of stories. And so it's really essential to our souls. Another old idea is fate. Fate is not fatality necessarily, but fate is what limits our lives or what had to happen to us. And when I was on my 13th birthday, my aunt happened to ask me what I wanted. And I was interested in history at the time. I was trying to figure out what the hell happened. Growing up in a poor neighborhood in New York, why is everyone so depressed in this neighborhood? And so she went off to get this history book, but she was very short. And she went into the bookstore and she said, I'm looking for a history book. And they pointed and she went and reached up and got a book. They wrapped it. She gave it to me. I start to tear the cover off and she goes, no, give it back. It's the wrong book. I'm looking at a flying horse with an archer on the back of the horse releasing this arrow arc and off the cover of the book. And I'm saying, I want this book. And she's saying, no, it's the wrong book. And then I ripped the rest of the paper off and it says Mythology by Edith Hamilton. So I got the right, wrong book, the unintended gift at that time at 13 years of age. I read almost that entire book that night. And what happened was I found a language. I didn't have to be older. I didn't have to be bigger. I didn't have to be richer. I didn't have to be anything except myself, because myths speak to you in a language that suits you. That's the power of myth. It's archetypal images, and we all interpret them ourselves. And so I found this language that made more sense to me than school or church or anything. And I didn't know it was a calling or a vocation. I just thought it was an amazing thing. And no one around me would give it any credit. I tried to talk to the teachers in school, what about this myth? And they thought, you know, that's fairy tales, whatever. So it took a while for that calling to become a way of life. But it was there in a moment when I opened that book. The first thing I read was Three Fates, the Sisters of Fate, and how they give you the thread of your life and how they give you the twist of fate that is the way in which you awaken to what your inner life is about. Practically the first thing I read, and I thought, that's the missing piece. I'm not getting that in school. I'm not getting that even in church.
That's huge. And I want to say you have the gift of being Irish. Can I just put that in there?
That helps, because you get the gift of gab, yeah.
The gift of gab, exactly, and I should know.
The key thing about it is everybody has that waiting to happen. It doesn't always happen in such a clear way, although it took me 20 years to figure out how to live with it. That goes back to an old idea, which is the first problem is you don't know your genius. The second problem is you know your genius, because now you have to live with it.
You've written extensively and spoken about the genius myth. Tell us more about that. I love that.
So genius is an old Latin word that literally means the spirit that's already there. So it was the name used for that mysterious, gifted part of a person that's already there when they're born. It manifests a little bit in childhood, particularly the years 9 to 11. Then it goes latent, they call it quiet and latent, and then it will manifest again in youth. And if it's not recognized or allowed to be, it will cause trouble. A lot of young people are in trouble because their genius is not being recognized and confirmed. And even though it's our natural gift, it has to be confirmed by someone outside ourselves. I talk in terms of a genius self, a part of oneself that has some genius. Now, modern people think genius is either high IQ or a specific talent. Not it. That can be it for some people. But some folks, their genius is their capacity to listen to other people. And everyone will tell them their life story and their deepest pains. And it's that's their gift. Some therapists have that. Some people's genius turns out to be an affinity for understanding death. And so talk about regenerative. Modern cultures now, you get death doulas. And when you really get down to regeneration, death becomes a critical aspect of understanding it because, I'm stepping off from genius now, but people talk about the mystery of life. The core mystery of life, according to all the old cultures, is life, death, renewal. That's in a forest, that's in a person, that's potentially in a culture. Life, death, renewal, or life, death, rebirth. So in traditional cultures around the world, each girl and boy would eventually enter a rite of passage based on the idea that you can't go from childhood to what we call adult or greater consciousness, whatever we're going to call it. You can't do that through a developmental process. That's a leap. The end of childhood, the developmental process happens until adolescence. Then no one knows what to do with those kids. It's not quite developmental anymore. It's complicated. And they don't respond to the earlier things that would cause them to pay attention. They have their own dreams. They have their own ideas. And at that point, that's when they invented rite of passage. The rite of passage would have a number of elements to it, but two of them would be awakening to one's own genius, awakening to what the genius or the gifted nature of the person is. And then the other part of it would be the beginning of the healing of the early life wounds, because humans so far have all had early life wounds. And so the soul path that we were talking about earlier, the growth of the soul, you could see it in these two directions. Developing the genius further, which is going to connect a person to nature, to animals, to other people, to vocations, to creativity, and at the same time, healing. Because the healing path is one's whole life. And healing is a Latin word that means to make whole. And so the only way to experience wholeness, oftentimes, is to get some more healing. So part of the growth of the soul is expansion of the giftedness, and the other side is the extension of the healing and becoming a more whole person in the sense of being healed.
Which reminds me of Jung, what he called individuation. And it has to do with integrating, let's say, aspects of the self or the soul, like soul retrieval, you could almost say. And that continues like throughout a lifetime, wouldn't you say?
I think the meaningful things all continue throughout a lifetime. Calling is an idea that young people get very quickly. We can call it vocation, call it calling. Something is calling to you, the thing that you actually need to hear and listen to, and is the path you need to follow. But I use the statement, the calling keeps calling. Most modern people do not have a calling. They might have a career, but that's a different thing. It even sounds like a different thing, like a career is more surface. A calling is this opening to things that are unexpected and mysterious, genius qualities. So the calling is so essential to human life that it keeps calling. And there definitely are stories of people who on the deathbed realize, oh, I get it.
Well, you know, I think about, you've worked with young men a lot in my awareness throughout your life. And I know on the island that you live on up in Washington, but also in Mendocino and other places, boys camps. And I think that's of particular interest to me about you, because I've just always known that. Tell me about working with youngers and then being an elder, because you and I at this point are elders. Have I fully had my rite of passage? And am I, you know, living out my proper eldership? And what is this work that you've been doing for so long, and why young men?
It actually started out with a series of projects that were working with severely at-risk communities, poor communities, usually communities of color, disadvantaged communities that included refugees as well as the barrio and the hood and that kind of thing. What happened is I was working with adults trying to do cultural healing, bringing together people that don't usually come together and airing out the grievances and all that kind of thing and finding hidden unity. And what happened, because of the way they were feeling the world, they started saying, can't we bring young people? I thought it would be good to work with the older people, and then the older people could work with the younger people, but they wanted the younger people there. So it actually was boys and girls. And so we had a project for 30 years called Voices of Youth. where we went into at-risk neighborhoods with the invitation of the people in the neighborhood and worked there with girls and boys to find their voice, because that's a key thing. And finding one's voice is different than learning how to speak. And then in the course of that, it turned out that we really had to work with not exactly boys, youth. And there's things that you do differently with young men than you do with young women. At the root, there's interchange and there's unity and so on. Really, it goes back to the way we're connected to the world. And so you almost need to have girls spend time with women who understand really the lunar cycles and the womb and things like that. And the boys need to be with older men who have figured out something about their own issues like anger and fear and grief. And so we then started to do a lot of work with young men. That's an amazing thing, because it turns out that what the men and youth have done traditionally is sing, play music, write poetry, speak to each other honestly, and reconnect to nature. So it winds up being like a rites of passage after the thought kind of thing. And in it, you learn a lot of things. And one way it's really valuable is now when you see certain men who have risen to places of power and influence. And you had already maybe mentioned the tech bros. And certainly in the United States, we have someone in charge who never went through a rite of passage from my point of view and is actually strikingly adolescent most of the time. So when a culture doesn't understand the importance of awakening the soul of its boys so that they can become open-hearted, psychically grounded, compassionate men, you then get these dissociative things that happen. In other words, someone can't be lacking in empathy for other people unless they have no empathy for themselves. Someone can't be excited about deporting everybody for whatever kinds of reasons unless they are self-alienated. We often now have people in power who actually are examples of the unawakened, examples of the undeveloped psyche. And maybe that's why they're there as symptoms to say, don't keep doing this. And if we're going to talk about regeneration and reconnecting the essential threads, boys need to be brought into a dynamic process through which they find some sense of their own genius and they get that confirmed. The old term was blessed, but also they need to be helped to open the wounds from early childhood so that they can get some healing, because that then becomes the source for empathy, for compassion, and for a deeper way of loving oneself and being forgiving of oneself. Boys that become men without learning about their souls are essentially lost on a psychic level, but they become kind of dangerous because they will keep acting out things that are more adolescent and are less connected, less compassionate, and less caring to themselves.
So men, let's say, who have had rites of passage, who have connection to their own self-nature, their own true nature, that's who needs to help guide. And so if we don't have as many initiated men, we need to start somewhere by creating men who have had a sense of self and initiation. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think it's necessary. You have people now who have unbelievable amounts of power and wealth at a level that would not have been possible in earlier times. And with the ability to manipulate and use technology, which has become much more dramatically developed than at any other time in history, if those people with that kind of power do not know that they are wounded inside, if they have managed to cover that up in various ways, they will act out those wounds. If we think about Mother Earth and the planet, which now needs our help because we've done a lot of damage to it, and many of them don't want to help the Earth. They want to leave the Earth. They want to colonize somewhere else and build gated communities on other planets. That is a depiction of a dissociation from their own home planet. I mean, it's what happens when people don't become grounded. They don't care about the Earth. They can exploit it, and they may want to leave it. Others just want to dominate it all the time. And none of those are healthy. And the issue is you can't suddenly recreate rites of passage, because that's actually a very tricky thing to do. But because rites of passage is archetypal, arche means ancient and typo means type or form. Because it's an original form, like mother is an archetype, father is an archetype, child is an archetype, but so is initiation or rite of passage. So it's actually happening in people's lives.
I see. So you need that witness of other in order for it to really make that difference in you, to catalyze maybe.
Yeah, that's a good word for it. And you can imagine it. In a modern world, a woman has a child. And she was a woman. She has the child. She's now a woman, but she's also a mother. She has an entire new title, which is one of the oldest, most powerful titles in the world. And it's not celebrated as such. Gifts for the baby. There's concerns about the baby. There's concerns about the mother, too. But the mother is now an initiated woman. She has had a brush with death, because every moment of birth could be a death. That's the nature of it. They're very close. They're the two most powerful things. In the course of that, a whole new life has entered the world through her. She is a different being. There's a whole world of knowledge that can be awakened in that process. And cultures used to then bless the mother. They used to finish the process by saying, we see, we know you've gone through the pain of labor. You've gone through the ordeal of uncertainty. You've had a brush with the elemental energies of life, and we want to welcome you back, a new person with a greater capacity that you got because you went through the rite of passage of giving birth. I mean, that's not even thought about. It's become a medical situation primarily, when it should be a mythical situation. So that's something that is not given to women.
I interviewed Laurel Phillips, who is a midwife, for the show, and absolutely, and I had the experience twice of working with a midwife, and it was profound, and it is so different than a hospital birth, I found, and it was so grounding, and taught my whole family these circles of support, everyone's included, and it put the whole thing into a very sacred space, which sometimes it just doesn't feel like that.
Mostly it doesn't. And the conclusion of the rite of passage was that a new soul entered the world, an entire new life never seen before, because everybody understands that each soul is unique. And that child comes in with gifts and aims, with a fate and hopefully a destiny. But in the meantime, the woman who has given birth to the child has gone through an altered state that is unparalleled, because it is utterly regenerative and completely, literally creative. So then she would be celebrated. And so that the moments of radical transformation and transition would be held long enough to become more conscious and then be confirmed and blessed. And then, you know, I don't know. I mean, I've not ever consciously been a woman, but I've assisted at 5 births. And it's mind-blowing how physical it is, how elemental it is, how soulful it is, how much it makes you want to laugh and cry, and how much joy there is and how much fear there is when things are uncertain, and how much care is going in all kinds of directions. But then it's usually over. And in most traditional cultures, the mother and child would be, you know, secluded for a while so that they could find each other in this outside relationship after 9 months of an inside relationship. And then after a week or so, the whole village would come and welcome the baby and say its name. They would have a naming ceremony. And then they would all bless the mother for bringing a child into the world. And since they knew that each child was gifted, they knew it was going to be beneficial to them. That was the understanding. And it wasn't strictly personal. It was deeply personal, but it was also strongly communal. And that child becomes their child, because that child has gifts that are intended to be given on a community level, not just on a family level.
So what I hear throughout what you say is an elevation of the feeling aspect. My unconscious, my dreams, my visions, my daytime waking, my nighttime, but also can we actually use our senses, our feelings, our emotions to guide us? And what I'm hearing from everything you're saying is the wise ones throughout time absolutely use these as aspects of the full self. And I'm aware that you have worked over the decades with psychologists and poets and artists and musicians. Could you talk a little bit about that? Like, because I think how I feel has not been given value. And so I'm still in the process of acknowledging and validating what I know because it's in my bones. Or, you know, you can make a list of things.
Yeah, something to be known has to be fully felt. And the feeling is in the blood. We know things in the blood. I'm thinking for a moment of Carl Jung, who I think was tremendously valuable to the modern world, because Freud was going to leave things in a difficult position, it seemed. And his student, Jung, was studying mythology. That's part of what was different. And so his ideas of the self came from ancient Chinese Taoism and mythology. So he was really speaking about this other element that had been banished, more or less, forgotten in the modern world. So he says there's four functions, that everyone has four, and that one is thinking, which everybody in the modern world, you know, knows about. But thinking has its own opposite, which is also important, which is feeling. So that if you don't have feeling to go with your thinking, then you're not fully integrated. And then the other two would be intuition, which is completely mysterious. It jumps from one thing to the other with no explanation. It's very different than thinking. But then intuitional function is paired with sensation. Now, William Blake comes to mind, who says if we understood the senses, we would know that they are spiritual as well as sensual, that each one is a door to the unseen. And again, a lot of this comes back to the feminine nature, because the feminine would be in some ways more essentially connected to feeling. I'm going back to birth. There is so much involved in it because it's the birth of a new being that hasn't even been in the world. And so it has to have intuitive elements and thought put into it, but also radical sensation and deep feelings. Jung distinguished between feeling and emotion. So a feeling is a felt emotion. The emotions can be utterly overwhelming and radical and destructive at times. Too much anger, that's destructive. Too much sorrow, they say that's a stone of the heart. And so feelings are like a conscious awareness of emotions. He imagined feeling to have a rational quality to it. It actually has the emotion at the base of it, but it has a way of more consciously handling the emotion so it becomes felt and not just rushing through everything. At least that's what he thought was feeling. Modern Western world is both sensational and overly committed to rational thinking. And so you lose intuition and you lose feelings. In certain cultures, those things are considered only for women.
And inferior. As a young person, I was a tomboy. I saw early on that the women hold the coats and the men are the heroes. And I was a big reader and they get to do the fun things. And so I tried to identify with math, logic, those kinds of things. Lo and behold, a Jungian analysis later, and I learned that I'm highly intuitive, and I know I'm in trouble if I'm trying to figure it out with logic. It's like, damn. And for me, my vastly inferior function was sensation. Let's say on the Myers-Briggs test is that intuition, but I don't see sensation as being the five senses. I always meant it to be like the show me state, kind of like I have to actually experience it and do it rather than it's about sight, smell, touch. And in that way, I have taken it on as a higher challenge because I can just intuit things. I don't need to travel. I just go there in the ethers. So that's what I know how to do. And I'm learning to accept that's my natural gift.
It can be a reality check. I'm an extroverted intuitive, so I know what you're talking about. I don't know how this works for listeners, but we were talking about being whole, finding healing and finding wholeness. And Jung has this brilliant idea about the inferior function. So just quickly stated, he says, if someone has their main function is intuition, then their inferior function will be sensation. If someone's main function is thinking, their inferior would be feeling. So whatever you are as your dominant function, you can bring two of the others to help you out. And over time, you expand your soul let's say you're a thinking person. Over time, you expand your soul by getting intuition and getting sensation, but you won't have easy access to feeling. Wholeness comes when you can tap into what he called the inferior function, in that case, feeling. In our case, the inferior is sensation. I've mentioned getting the book on my birthday, and now I'm into this world of myth, which is totally intuitive and never really existed anywhere. Myth's not about being believed. They're about learning. They're not about the truth as facts. They're about the truths of life. And they're so moving because they're ancient and they're immediate at the same time. And they talk to each person in their own language. You know, I don't need fairy tales or the stories that people are tracking. I'm having these mythic experiences all the time. But it's not very grounding. And so eventually what happened to me is I loved the stories and I was trying to tell stories. And it wasn't working that well until I stumbled into drumming. So I started to learn drumming on an instinct and an accident almost. And now drumming's all sensation. You're now sitting, you have a drum between your legs if you're doing traditional hand drumming, and it's all about your body and mostly your lower body. And you're now getting into the rhythm and you're getting all your sensations tied into rhythm. And so all of a sudden I started telling stories while drumming, and it was like finding a whole level of reality for me. Because then I wasn't remembering the story. I was seeing it. It still happens. I see it. And each time I see it, it's different. And I can see differences. And so it makes it very alive. But that began my understanding of how we feel whole by finding a part of ourselves that we are uncomfortable with, which turns out to be the key to intensifying the dynamic of the whole psyche.
And what I feel like you're saying is that through drumming, in your case, there's more than one way to do this. There's a slight bit of trance that is created through rhythmic sounding, and it can be achieved other ways, but that from what I understand, you're accessing what you might call the subconscious. So what's just below consciousness. I've heard it said that's where truth dwells. I mean, the ego consciousness is ready to play all kinds of games, you know, if you're up for it. But when you can kind of loosen that grip of your identities and your roles and social propriety and just get into what is true and what's coming through. And that is what I'm currently doing with a book project I'm working on, where I'm working from that place, having been overeducated. I have to make that part be quiet so that I can get to this other part, because I believe there's something there to be communicated. And it seems that drumming is something that you've used, but there are other ways.
Each person can find their own way. Each person has access to a number of languages. You may only ever speak English, for instance, but you still have access to all kinds of languages. Dance is a language. Song is a language. People that feel compelled to be near animals and talk about sensation, they have a sense of touch that is not simply described by the five senses, and they share that with animals who have a similar sense of unusual sensate touch. And so part of the idea of healing is to become a whole person, and the whole person will have these dynamics. Jung cooked it down to four, but I mean, that's just for convenience in a way. What you mentioned is right. What I learned about drumming is you learn trance rhythms and you entrance the audience, which is also called enchanting the audience. And enchanting sounds like singing. And so people used to tell stories while playing instruments, and the listeners would let go so that they could feel this knowledge that's right below the surface. And releasing themselves into the story, the ego goes quiet. And now you have transmission. If you take these old stories to be vehicles of knowledge, you have direct transmission to anyone who is hearing the story with their inner ears. And I remember being at this conference early on when I was learning how to tell stories and talk to audiences and so on. And I was at this rather large conference. It was all academics. It was all a lot of psychologists there and so on. And I told a story while drumming, which surprised a lot of people. And then I interpreted it. And someone in the audience said, I have a question. Where did you get the ideas from? And I said, oh, from the story. And they said, oh, which book are you getting from? And I said, I didn't get it from a book. I got it from the story. The story is telling me how to understand it or how I can understand it. And it caused a controversy in the audience about, you mean you could have an idea that didn't come from a book? And I said, yeah, stories are the oldest school for humanity. If something happens, we want to hear the story. We're back to the idea of story. And traditional cultures, usually the storytellers were also playing instruments, or somehow music would get involved. I think there's a connection there. How do we survive these troubled times we're in, which are not going to settle soon? There's no election going to settle it. There's no agreement going to settle it. We are in a liminal, disruptive, potentially transformative space. And in order to get through it and not get broken apart or overly anxious, we need those things that settle the soul and open the psyche to experiences that are not predictable. And I'm talking about music, dance, art, anything that has creative energy in it and shift us into a place that is psychologically and psychically regenerative. I believe I have to watch the news. I feel like I have to be a witness to the collapse and an assistant to the renewal, and that both are required.
Yeah, you're one of the elders. You got to watch the horizon, see if the marauders are coming, you know.
And then to know how people are suffering and why they're suffering, if there's going to be healing, like the healers have to open the wound. So I feel there's a requirement for me, not, I'm just talking about myself. So I will watch the news, and all of a sudden now I feel disturbed. I've probably taken in some toxicity. So I'm either going to go dive into a body of water and swim and clean that up, which is a favorite ritual for me, or music. I will just go to music. I will play the drum, or I'll listen to music, or I'll sing along with a recording. And all of a sudden you can feel the body shift, and then the psyche shifts. And then usually I'm kind of ready, you know, to go on to the next thing. So I'm suggesting we need healing practices to get through our daily lives at this kind of time on earth.
Right. And these kinds of moves can help those of us that have gotten overwhelmed and can't handle what's going on. So transformation to the average person, let's say me, feels like it means we're either going to be here or we're going to be gone. And that's what we do with it. But what you're saying, there's a third option, which is kind of like a both and. It's not going to be the same, but it's going to be new.
The new is trying to happen always. You used the word emergence when we first started. It's a brilliant word. It comes from birth. It's connected to birth. But it's also connected to ancient stories, creation myths, where people came from below. They came up through the earth, and they were assisted by ants and spiders and other animals to come into life. And so we're in this process of emergence. Something's trying to emerge as a new arrangement of the world that comes after the collapse of the other world occurs. But something's trying to emerge in each of our lives. And we're each here to do something meaningful and something creative. We're each here to be involved in the great drama of love in some fashion. There's an old African proverb that says, what you love is the cure. The implication is life is the illness and what you love is the cure. And so when the world is falling apart and everything seems more polarized, less humane, then we have to find our love cure. What we love is the cure. And for some people, it's going to be dance. For some people, it's going to be walking in the forest. For other people, they have to dig a hole. That does it. And for other people, it's going to be song. And prayer is something that is endless and is always being reinvented. It doesn't mean repeating a particular script. That's a creed you can repeat. Prayer is anytime you realize where you are. You just use the words that come. Some people need to pray. That's what moves them. And then it turns out that each time you pray is new. Something emerges. The words come out differently if we actually allow it to happen. People used to make prayers on the spot that were not repetitive. They were as poetic speaking that makes the moment prayerful. Easiest thing in the world once you have access to it. So anyway, there's any number of things that become practices that both expand our soul, deepen our sense of psyche, and give us a greater resilience and stability in a world that's tearing itself apart.
That is so perfect. I feel like I could go on for another hour, but in the interest of both of us, I'm going to say thank you so much for teasing out some of these ideas. And what I'm taking away is this notion of love, this notion of really allowing and engaging in practices that change up my stuck sense of self, like immerse yourself in water, go out in a walk in nature, listen to music, play a drum. Brilliant idea. Anything can be an instrument, really.
They're all instruments. They're all languages. And they're all trying to teach us. In Aboriginal Australia, they have a saying, yoro, yoro. Near as I can tell, what it means is everything standing up alive, talking to you. Are you going to respond?
That's fantastic. All right. Well, on that note, thank you so much. And thank you for all of your offerings that just keep coming. I'm there most of the time. So I invite everyone else to join you.
Okay. Well, great to see you. And thank you for such a lively conversation.
Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.